We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrix. Joining me today is Jim Forsyth, former New Hampshire state senator, U.S. Air Force pilot, chairman for Citizens for Sound Money, and partner at Silverback Precious Metals. Thanks for joining me today, Jim.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back on so soon.
Oh, it's great to have you back. So, you know, I'd like to kind of go over some things today with you that are kind of the foundations of, let's say, why we all believe in gold and silver. So why don't we start with asking you, what's the vision for Citizens for Sound Money?
Yeah, so Citizens for Sound Money, it's a 501c4 that we started back in March of last year. And our goal is really twofold, which is to encourage people to use sound money, and second, to defend their right to do so. And that second part, you know, would involve lobbying efforts. We're teaming up with Sound Money Defense League on that. Mm-hmm. The first part, it's really a call to action to start using gold and silver as money, sound money. In other words, not wait for the government to back the currency, not push for the government to back the currency, because they'll mess it up again. But, you know, people chose gold and silver naturally as money through time. You know, in barter transactions, you know, one person doesn't have what the other person needs. It's kind of a multi-person exchange. And so you have to find a medium of exchange, and silver and gold naturally arose to serve that purpose.
Mm-hmm. So what happened in 1971 to really facilitate this drop in purchasing power in the dollar?
Yeah, and it really started back in 1913 with the formation of the Federal Reserve. And, you know, they had the credit expansion of the Roaring Twenties that was made possible by the Fed, and then the subsequent collapse of the Great Depression. And so the first devaluation happened, you know, back during the Depression when they confiscated gold and then changed from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. So the, you know, the disconnect between money and gold already started back then. But then, you know, since U.S. owners couldn't hold gold, but foreign countries could redeem dollars for gold once we became the world reserve currency, all the spending in Washington, you know, the guns and butter policy led to massive money printing compared to the gold reserves, and other countries saw that and started pulling out their gold. So Nixon closed the gold window. And so that's when we became truly fiat. And he had to then go, you know, get an agreement with oil producing nations to sell oil only for dollars in order to have, you know, some confidence in the dollar and, you know, basically get it to people to use it. And so we went from a gold back standard really to kind of an oil back standard. And, you know, the real tragedy of that, of the dollar system is, you know, that the people that get the money first, you know, when the money gets printed, people get it first, you know, they profit immensely. And then the people in the, you know, middle class, lower class, don't see their wages increase. And this Triffin's dilemma really talks about this of, you know, when you become the world reserve currency and it's a fiat system, there's nothing to balance trade with gold as money. You know, as if you have a trade surplus, gold starts to accumulate in your country, which then essentially devalues the gold in your country. Then it makes it, you know, other countries more competitive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all the manufacturing in the U.S. has gone overseas because of this issue. And, you know, it's caused a lot of problems and really hollowed out our manufacturing base.
So, you know, just as an example, let's say, how many dollars have been printed, you know, in the last 2 years, basically since the start of the pandemic?
Yeah, I forget the exact number, but I want to say, what was it, like 25 or 50% of all the dollars ever in existence were then printed. I know that first year, 25% more dollars were printed. And then the year after, it's been an annualized rate of about 13%. So that's a massive move. And, you know, people talk about, you know, it's velocity that causes inflation, not the money printing. But, you know, you see the velocity dropped. Well, velocity is exchange of dollars divided by quantity of dollars. So if you print 25% more dollars with no changes, velocity is going to drop. Mm-hmm. But I think of it as, you know, the money printing is the inflation, the monetary inflation, and it's just latent inflation. You know, once those dollars are printed, it's just a matter of time before you start to see the prices increase. And, you know, over the years, we've been able to export our inflation. But as a friend of mine in Latin America said, this, you know, those dollars are coming back, mm-hmm. you know, so not only have we printed a mass amount of money, but then if you look at what's going on with Russia and Ukraine and sanctions, you know, some of those dollars are going to come back here, and that's going to add fuel to the fire.
So, Jim, you know, when we think about, let's say, having a gold-backed currency, does that in some ways change the morality around how money is used and the behavior and constrain the government to actually try to really make the best decisions for how to use that currency or that money?
Yeah, absolutely. It does place massive constraints on the government, which is why they don't like it and why they broke from it. If you look back at World War II, you watch old movies, you know, they were pitching war bonds, you know, buy war bonds, support the war. That doesn't happen anymore, right? They just don't even bother to declare war. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't go to Congress, they don't bother to declare war, and then they just print the money to make the war happen. So, I truly believe that, you know, sound money is at the root of a whole number of issues. You know, the erosion of the middle class, the growing wealth disparity, all the wars that we've had. You know, if you fix our monetary system, then a lot of these problems get fixed.
Mm-hmm. So do we not need a flexible currency supply to help, you know, to grow with the population and grow with the growth of industry to facilitate more trade and to expand as the economy does?
No, I mean, that's one of the arguments that used against gold. But if you look at, you know, the annual mining supply of gold, it actually increases roughly with the population. But this idea that deflation is a, you know, that if you had a fixed monetary supply and you had deflation, that it would be a bad thing is, in my head, my view, wrongheaded. I mean, what's bad about if you save money, even if it doesn't produce interest, if you save up your money, it'll have more purchasing power in the future. That's a great thing. And that's actually what was happening in one of the arguments in the book, The Creature from the Jekyll Island, he makes is people were increasingly being wealthy and not needing to borrow money. You know, they'd save because, you know, we were on a gold standard then. They'd save, productivity increases would make things cheaper and cheaper. And, you know, they could buy things without taking loans. You know, and now you look a century later with all the productivity increases and, you know, people are taking loans to just go buy basic stuff. You know, it's amazing nowadays that, you know, when you go shopping for the least little thing, it's like you can get a 0%, you know, 6-month loan for buying this, you know, dishwasher or
a bike helmet or something small. Yeah.
But that was, in my opinion, the goal of the creation of the Federal Reserve is to encourage debt and discourage savings. So no, it's in my opinion, not true. And if you study Austrian economics, it's not true that, you know, you need a flexible money supply. What you need is a stable, predictable, money supply and, preferably one that has a store value, which means it would not be inflated.
So when we think about, you know, basically the interest rate or the price of currency to be able to borrow it and get it, that also kind of plays in some ways, the morality and a role in the types of assets that currency ends up getting invested in, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you have artificial interest rates are essentially normally in a free market system, a signal of the desire to spend now versus later, mm-hmm. or the desire to spend, you know, later. And interest rates are a balancing mechanism for that. Tom Woods does great talks on this. He talks a lot about it. But, you know, when you artificially set interest rates low, it encourages very reckless behavior. And, you know, that was really the genesis of the housing bubble, is low interest rates, you know, basically tricked people into saying, let's build all these houses, you know, when the demand wasn't actually there. And then that bubble collapsed. And throughout history, even tulip mania, You see these bubbles get created and burst, and at the heart of it is always money printing and or artificial interest rates. And, you know, the roaring 20s, essentially, you know, Federal Reserve gets created, starts artificially setting interest rates, and we immediately get the roaring 20s. Everybody thinks we're rich, and then that collapses into a worldwide depression. Mm-hmm. So it's insane to think that a handful of people are smarter than the market and can go set interest rates. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned before that the sanctions in Russia could play a role in kind of bringing some of this inflation back to the U.S. when the U.S. has really exported all these dollars. So, you know, obviously this inflationary scenario and this level of money printing existed before, you know, before the pandemic, before the Russia-Ukraine situation. So before we get into that, why didn't we see the massive type of inflation that we are now when the U.S. had the QE program and interest rates as low as they have been?
You mean like back in 2008 or versus like 2010?
Or let's say, 2020? Yeah, let's say even from 2008 to 2019.
Yeah, so I'm not really an expert on that, but my understanding is that, you know, the artificial low interest rates didn't necessarily increase circulation. Mm-hmm. As much. You know, banks were kind of hunkered down, not wanting to borrow. But then, yeah, I mean, over the decades, it's been as we print these dollars, we send them overseas to buy stuff. Mm-hmm. And so essentially, you know, we export our inflation overseas, especially Latin American countries. That's really started to change long before the Russia-Ukraine thing. Mm-hmm. But if you look, you know, China, even before the recent events, was starting to, you know, use their dollars to go buy commodities. You know, and that's run up the prices of commodities, you know, because I'm sure they see this coming. And, you know, Russia's been de-dollarizing for years, you know, because of the, you know, they knew the risk of sanctions. And, you know, China also has been drawing down its treasuries. Mm-hmm.
So now when we look at the Russia-Ukraine situation, I know, you know, before we hit record here, we were kind of talking about that. Why could these sanctions lead to a lot of these dollars coming back and causing more inflation?
Well, you know, to really answer that question, I highly recommend your interview with Luke Roman. I mean, that was outstanding. And I'm a subscriber of his. Follow him heavily. So you know, and he makes the point that, you know, other countries could say, well, Russia's on the bad list. You know, we'll be fine as long as we're not on the bad list. Mm-hmm. But, you know, throughout history, you know, remember freedom fries, right? So at one point, France was on our bad list. Mm-hmm. So, Russia was not just about, you know, keeping them out of the SWIFT system. They actually froze the reserve assets. So that's not saying you can't use dollars. It's the dollars you already have, you're not going to be able to do anything with. Mm-hmm. So other countries, I'm sure, you know, this is a trend we already saw, like I mentioned, of de-dollarizing, all these countries de-dollarizing, but this is just going to accelerate the trend for sure. Mm-hmm.
And of course, you've studied the Soviet system and were over there a long time ago. So that obviously gives you a particular perspective that many people don't have. So is there anything that you'd like to share with us about Russia or the Soviet system like that, that you think a lot of people could be missing?
Well, first off, remember that, you know, this isn't the Soviet system, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, that was the biggest tragedy, because I guess the number one lesson I learned by going over there was the country, we Americans tend to think of the government and the country and the people all as one thing. Mm-hmm. Okay? But they're not. And that's becoming more true in America. But in the Soviet Union, just absolutely wonderful people. And I got to visit Ukraine, wonderful people, Georgia. The people were the victims of the government versus, you know, being part of it. And so that was my big lesson, is, you know, to have some compassion for the people over there. And when the Soviet Union broke up, we, very tragically did not try to embrace the former Soviet republics, you know, into kind of free society. We kept expanding NATO. We treated it as if the enemy had never been defeated, but the enemy was communism, not Russia, right? But I think, you know, the military industrial complex needs an enemy, and so we continue to treat them very belligerently, mm-hmm. and that's played a role in where we are today, unfortunately. And so you know, hopefully we can move past this and get peace over there. And the other thing to say is for anybody that's painting this black and white, it's as far from black as white as can be. I mean, all you have to think about is, you know, what was Hunter Biden's role over there? Like, what are all these connections? Mm-hmm. I definitely recommend people look at Bryce Mitchell's little video clip when they ask him about Ukraine. I love what he had to say about that. He's an MMA fighter.
Right. Yeah. You know, this kind of virtue signaling where some of these companies and organizations take, for example, and I know we'll get a lot of funny comments, of course, being Canadian, I was going to mention the NHL kicking out some of the Russian players, you know, attacking and victimizing the people that have nothing to do with the actual decisions that are being made by the government. It creates more division, and it doesn't actually help the situation at all, right?
It's quite insane. I mean, at the height of the Cold War, you know, when we, you know, Reagan's calling these the evil empire, and we joked about, oh yeah, when I went there, I was like, we're going to the belly of the beast. But we didn't do that. We understood, you know, that the Russian people were people as well. And, you know, many emigrated here and we opened up our arms to them. And now it's crazy. Yeah. They're going to outlaw Russian dressing, which was actually invented in New Hampshire.
Yeah. And even, I mean, there was another example I saw that, I know in Canada, they were taking Russian vodka off of the liquor store shelves. And it's, you know, you think about that and you think, well, it's already been paid for. How is this at all punishing Russia? Like, what effect is that going to have?
Well, yeah. And was it close to 50% of the Ukrainian population is ethnically Russian, right? So, yeah. And so when people talk about like, whose side are you on? It kills me. I'm on the Ukrainian people's side. I'm on the Russian people's side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's a good way to put it. You're on the people's side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's not just two sides to this involvement for sure. You know, NATO, the United States, it's definitely not simple. Mm-hmm. And the more and more I read about it, the more frustrated I get at how we got here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, kind of getting back to our original topic here, Jim, how was gold and silver seen by the founding fathers and how is it included in the Constitution?
Well, gold and silver is definitely seen as money. And they had the experience with the continental dollar, you know, where they had a massive inflation of that. And I think Britain tried to introduce counterfeit continentals. But besides that, to pay for the war effort, basically, they engaged in money printing. And so they understood that. They understood the problems with that. And they put into the Constitution that, you know, only gold and silver will be money. I can't remember the exact words. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. Yeah, they'd be rolling over in the graves to see what we're doing now. And, you know, people can say, well, that was, you know, that's historic. That's ancient times. But this is something that's played out. I think somebody said like 6,000 times in history where you had fiat currencies, mm-hmm. you know, or you had the Romans who were diluting their coins, clipping their coins, then, you know, watering down the content. And time after time, the life cycles are like generally 30 to 50 years. You know, the track record for fiat being successful is zero out of all those times. Mm-hmm. And you know, I expect the same to be true this time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my big thing with Citizens for Sound Money is to urge people. Because I was one of them. I was like, you know, we need a dollar backed by gold. We need a dollar backed by gold. Not in this century, you don't. You know, there's great resources, asset-backed digital currencies, we call them, you know, gold and silver on blockchain. physical. And I just got to interview the founder of Goldbacks, and you know, these things are beautiful. Mm-hmm. This is 1/1000th of an ounce, and their rate of acceptance is supposedly really pretty high, you know, when you explain what it is. So there's lots of options. You know, the dollar is still currency. You know, you're going to need it in a lot of exchanges, but you don't have to hold that. You know, you can hold sound money and start using it. And I think a number of people, I think Rick Roll has said this, and it's a thought I had already had, is, you know, it may seem selfish to save yourself by, you know, holding gold and silver, but it's one of these things that if everybody does the right thing for themselves and their families by protecting themselves, we wind up solving the bigger issue. You know, as more and more people use sound money, we really solved the issue that you know, 1971 gave us.
So in a way, you see this as a possibility to have a ground level response to a problem that has come from the top down. Do you see that as a path to getting back to sound money and the ability to kind of reconstrain and reclaim some of the value that's being eroded from the dollars that are being printed?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly how I see it. So I forget his name, Havel, I think, a Czech dissident, talked about like creating a, you know, when you're ruled by authoritarians, that what you can do is create a parallel society. And that's exactly what we envision, is creating a parallel society that uses sound money, that grows over time, to kind of escape the system. And, you know, you can look at what happened to the banks in Canada with the truckers. You can look what happened to Russia. You know, our nonprofit, because of what we're doing, has gone through 3 payment processors. You know, we have a hard time keeping them. We don't even bother now. We're doing all our transactions with gold and silver, you know, on the blockchain and crypto as well. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly that's the direction we should head in. And you know, that secondary role of sound money is important, because as we head that direction, as it grows momentum, you know, there's going to be backlash. And we need to be able to prevent that. And I see the states as our best allies in that. So really excited about what Sound Money Defense League is doing. Because, you know, having been in the legislature, states can be a lot more open-minded. Plus, you know, they're not the ones directly benefiting from the dollar printing. That's DC is. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, it's easier to prevent legislation than it is to pass legislation. So, you know, if we take a mode of we're going to start using it in our personal lives rather than lobbying the government to adopt it, it's easier to defend against them taking that right away. And it is a right, because remember that money wasn't created by governments. Money rose naturally from the people. The governments get involved with it and they start coining, and then they mess it up.
Yeah. And, you know, when we think about how the politics at the local level reacts to what the people want, as you say, it's easier to kind of recognize and make changes at that level, and then at the state level to react to, as I said, the local population's needs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, New Hampshire is a great example. It's the third largest legislative body in the world, behind the US and India. So there's 400 state reps and, you know, 1 million people. So it's a state rep per like 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. So good luck lobbying, you know, somebody who can get elected because he knows everybody in his town. You know, it's much harder to control people like that. You know, it's true grassroots, connect to the people. But that's true for all the states in general, to a greater or lesser extent, is they're just much closer to the people. And plus, they're not the ones directly benefiting from the money printing.
That's kind of an interesting idea, though. You know, if there's that many, I hate to say it like that, but bureaucrats and politicians, you know, obviously there could be an argument made against that, to say that there's too many people in that system.
Too many people in
too many state representatives, kind of a too top heavy of a bureaucracy. Or is it that you're saying that it's a better system simply because they know and understand what the people need and want better?
Yeah, there are definitely trade-offs. So, you know, one trade-off is you know, when you have one rep per 3,000 people, it can be hard to get good people to run. Mm-hmm. But the big advantage is, you know, the larger voting block that you have to get, the more money it takes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our Senate districts were like 60,000 people. Generally, a Senate campaign, state Senate, you know, $20,000 to $100,000. State rep campaigns, you know, when there's, you're trying to get 3,000 votes, a lot of state reps don't spend a dime. Mm-hmm. You know, they know the people in their town, and the people in their town know them and, you know, trust them and elect them. Mm-hmm. So it makes it very closer to representation by the people, for sure. Mm-hmm. And that was the big disadvantages that I think it was the 17th Amendment when that got put into place. Or was it repealed? Put in place. Our U.S. senators used to be voted on by state legislators instead of a popular vote. And that may seem, oh, well, it's not very democratic, but, you know, we're not supposed to be democracy, we're supposed to be a representative republic. And, you know, how much time do people have to research their U.S. Senate candidate? They get a bunch of mail, get a bunch of, a bunch of TV ads, and they get convinced to vote for them. Meanwhile, the state legislators, that's their full-time job, is to look at politics and to research it. So, you look at New Hampshire with one representative for 3,000 people, that means, you know, a much better control over the federal government that we had back then. And anyway, we'd have senators shoving bills down our throat like real ID. Well, if the legislators were electing the U.S. senators, we'd just say, what the heck are you doing? You're going to be out of here. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to shove these things down our throats. That was a little bit of a tangent, but
not a problem, Jim. You mentioned the Sound Money Defense League earlier. So do you guys do any work with and alongside them to help remove some of the state taxes on gold and silver?
We're just getting started working with them. We interviewed JP, I think about a month ago, and we had a great conversation offline. And, you know, we offered to help out. Our first step, given my background, was to go talk to some folks in New Hampshire. So we ran the idea, or I ran the idea, or JP drafted up something that would allow, New Hampshire to hold reserves in gold. So that's a bill that's passed in some other states. And the reception actually was good. They said that sounds like a good idea. It's a little late in this session to do it, but we can look at it next year. Mm-hmm. They're very active right now. We're just working with him. And when they have legislation that's on in different states, we will email the members from our states and urge them to take action. But we plan to increasingly work with him. But he's definitely driving that that effort and doing a fantastic job.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I'd like to kind of go back to something that you had touched on earlier. What is an ABDC?
So asset-backed digital currency. That was a coin phrase. Nate Fisher was involved in that discussion, and then our group, because if you say stable coins, people think USDT, which has a set of problems. If you say crypto, you know, people think Bitcoin, Ethereum. And so crypto gold or something like that just didn't have the right, I think, connotation to people. So asset-backed digital currency. So it's basically a blockchain, an asset that's been put, the ownership of it is then put on the blockchain. So for ease of transfer, divisibility, gold and silver, really the popular ones, with gold most popular. But I expect that we'll see this as an increasing trend over the years to, you know, platinum, palladium, to start putting ownership of those on the blockchain. And for us, it's our belief for it to serve as a useful currency, there has to be a redemption ability at a reasonable quantity, right? Because a currency should be able, you know, blockchain's not completely private. You should be able to make private transactions with money. And so there has to be that physical aspect as well. And in order to do that, you have to have some sort of redemption ability.
Mm-hmm. So what are some examples of these asset-backed digital currencies?
Yeah. So the ones we've had on our channel so far as Load, Cash Gold, and Kinesis. Those are the ones we've talked about. There are others as well, but Pax Gold is a big one. But the redemptions, I can't remember what it is, but it's like huge. I don't know if it's like basically a bar, one of those big good delivery bars of gold, but it's not a good one. So we don't really consider that a asset-backed digital currency.
So in a way, these tools are really just trying to help facilitate the usefulness of having a gold-backed or silver-backed currency that is able to be used in everyday transactions.
That's exactly right. So the intent is not, you know, this is what you use to put your retirement savings into. It's this is what you're going to use as a checking savings account. The interesting thing is, you know, more and more getting debit cards. The new Kinesis debit card that'll be coming out, and I think this might be true of other ones as well. When you swipe to pay for something, you don't have to have a cash balance. When you swipe to pay, they can then cash out some of your gold to pay for the product. So you can basically minimize your exposure to the US dollars, which I think increasingly could become very important.
So we've touched on this on the show several times, but how do you really know that these tokens are actually backed by what they say they are?
In my opinion, the number one thing that's needed is redemption policy. Right. If there's a robust redemption policy and they welcome it, then that's a good sign. Audits are another one. That's one of the things I found most interesting about Cash Gold is they have something called Gram Chain, which is essentially a blockchain audit. So when gold comes into or out of the system, then that's put onto the blockchain so that you have record of it and you can compare, what the blockchain's saying in terms of the physical assets versus what the blockchain's saying about the digital assets. Mm-hmm. And then that system is operated by an independent company. So that's pretty exciting. And that's something kind of pushing all these systems to adopt is some sort of at least daily inventory system, preferably third party, but definitely audits as well. But the audits need to not only audit the physical holdings, but then do a comparison with the blockchain tokens as well to make sure it's one-to-one.
And that's kind of an interesting system too. I've personally looked at it, and you can actually look at, as you say, the audit reports and see exactly what is in the vaults and backing their tokens, right?
Yep. So, all these systems have strengths and advantages. Some are further ahead in one area, further behind in other areas. I definitely view it as, you know, we've gotten so used to the Federal Reserve and a world reserve currency that we think in terms of, well, what's going to be the next system? Mm-hmm. But before the Federal Reserve, you know, our founders were, well, not all our founders, were dead set against the central bank. You know, that was the big debate between Jefferson and Hamilton. Because they wanted decentralization. So before the Fed, you know, you have your gold, you deposit in your local bank and you get a certificate. And that might be the bank certificate versus a US note or something like that. And then people would trade those certificates. Mm-hmm. That decentralization was encouraged competition to keep people honest. So leverage ratios were maybe 2-1, 3-1 in these banks. Sometimes one would get irresponsible and it would go out of business. But then when the Federal Reserve comes along, the leverage ratios blow out to like 10-1 and, you know, everything's reckless. So we don't want a single system. And that's why we're, you know, happy to give multiple asset-backed digital currency companies, you know, exposure. And, you know, we don't want one system to come out of it. We want this to be a competition. We want the strengths of one to be seen by the others and improve and bounce ideas off each other and work together to replace fiat versus working against each other. Because all these companies are just absolutely tiny in the grand scheme of things right now. And I expect that space to really explode. So there's definitely plenty of market share to go around.
Yeah, that's a great point and a great way to see it, Jim. So when you go through some of the terms and conditions of some of these programs, they seem to have some very interesting verbiage at times. So how do you know your assets are actually protected if something happens through the program?
Yeah, so that that was what inspired me to try to get back on your show is Bob Coleman's talk. And I have a lot of respect for Bob. And you know, he brought up the terms and conditions. And so Systems for Sound Money now has a lawyer on board, and we've had him review terms and conditions. And it's definitely, you know, there's a lot of hold harmless language, and that seems to be across the space. My guess is that, you know, this is such a new thing, you know, and there's not really a regulatory framework, so they're being cautious, you know, lawyers being lawyers. You know, and I don't think users have ever really weighed in on that. So I appreciate that he highlighted that issue. We've done a review, and we're going to reach out to different groups and then try to get some language pushed towards the users in it, if that makes sense. And our lawyer had some good suggestions on some things that could be included. But now, specifically at the end of that, he called out Kinesis, and I think he said something like it's the strongest language. When the lawyer basically, but then in tweets, he would say, you know, they all have language like this. And when our lawyer looked at it, a better way to describe it, it was the most complete one versus, you know, the strongest one. But Kinesis, is increasingly headquartering in Liechtenstein, and Liechtenstein passed the Blockchain Act, which allows digital tokens, which represent ownership and assets, to have legal title to those assets. And then there was also language in there talking about, you know, the language is basically of all these says they can terminate their services, right? But there's language underneath that says, in that case, if the service is terminated, you will have 5 days to withdraw your assets. So it's you know, even the agreement as it stands is not saying that they get to take over your assets. It's just, you know, you're using a system, you know, the website, the exchange, et cetera. Your right to use that system may go away, but your right to the ownership in the metal does not go away. But we're definitely going to work with different, you know, as Citizens for Sound Money, trying to improve things for users. And that's something I, you know, when I talked to Bob about this months ago, I said, send me your critique and I'd be happy to pass it on. Mm-hmm. And I never got that. So so we're just going to do it ourselves, get lawyers involved and try to see if we can improve language to you know, make users more comfortable as well and to provide them some protections.
So, you know, if we think about that particular case where you said that you would have 5 days to withdraw your assets, let's say, would you be notified of that or how do you know how that would work?
In the user agreement, it says that. It says, you know, if they, we're talking specifically about the Kinesis one, it says, you know, if, you know, because, you know, imagine, you know, somebody hacks your account, right? You, in that case, you want them to freeze your account because somebody's hacked your account. So that's what some of the language deals with. But I think there was something that says, you know, they will notify you within 24 hours or something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definite notification for sure.
So just to summarize that whole point is that a lot of the language, while it can seem restrictive, it is early days and this is an evolving process. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. And, you know, I think those user agreements are going to evolve over time. I think these companies are doing a new thing that's risky. And so they're trying to, you know, lawyers will be lawyers, right? I mean, if you read the terms of service to almost anything, you'll be, you know, aghast at what it says in there. There's all sorts of language. And keep in mind, you know, if you go bungee jumping, they're going to have you sign something that says, you're not legally responsible if I die. But that's not true, right? If things go bad and you sue them, you're going to win. You know, and I think it's the same thing here with the user agreements. I think the most important thing is to look at, you know, the people involved, the reputation, also, you know, I'm still a big believer in free markets, and you know, these people have an incentive to grow the system and do the right thing. The other perspective I'll add is, you know, Bob and I had a really good discussion about this, and at one point he says, "Well, I see gold and silver as insurance and investment, right? Well, I see gold and silver as money. I see it as insurance and investment as well, but I also see it as money." So that kind of colors his way of looking at these programs. Is he's looking at it from the kind of a stacker point of view, right? And if you are a stacker and it's there as your insurance, sure, you know, do vaulted storage, you know, pay for it. But if you're trying to use it in day to day life as money, these systems are really the only way to do it. You know, digital, you know, vault's not going to do that for you. So I think he and I are coming at it from different perspectives, but I definitely, you know, everybody should have some physical at home for sure. You know, not so much that you can't sleep at night thinking you're going to get robbed, but enough, you know, if and when things go bad, that you're prepared. You know, if the electricity's off, you don't have to worry about it. But, you know, there are some interesting aspects to these programs, like, you know, if you have to flee your country, right? Well, Kinesis has vaults in 9 different countries. So you could flee, go to a different country, and then redeem your physical over there. So you literally can take your gold with you across borders. So risk assessment's incredibly important. He highlighted some risk, but there's risk, you know, in other areas as well. And it's, but then also what's your goal? Is your goal is insurance, or is your goal, you know, using it as money?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. And, you know, just going back to what you said, if you know, a bungee jumping company has a waiver that says you waive your rights, and if something does go bad, you can sue them and you would win, then what's the whole point of the waiver or that legal language?
The whole point, I mean, we're in a very litigious society, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole point is to, you know, I think try to prevent the suits, but then also it can take some of the, you know, get rid of some of the frivolous ones. You know, that language then gives them, if there's a frivolous lawsuit, they can say, well, look, you signed this. And so I think it gives them some out, but it's definitely that kind of language is not going to stop a lawsuit when things are, you know, negligent for sure.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Jim, do you think there's anything else worth covering kind of on that asset-backed digital currency topic?
No, I think I made the main points I wanted to. I just, again, you know, thanks to Bob for highlighting the issue generically. Mm-hmm. I think going into some specifics was, you know, perhaps not a good thing to do, especially, he didn't disclose that he was involved with Load, which, you know, I don't think that's why he said the things he did at all, but, you know, we're trying to elevate the whole space and then keep everybody honest and, you know, help them make improvements versus try to scare people away from using gold and silver as money. Mm-hmm. You know, don't put all your assets into something unless you really trust it, but, you know, putting a little bit in there, using it as a checking account, you know, can be very helpful to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, Bob has been, I would say, a great champion in this space to help try and educate everyone around risks he sees, risks that people might not see, and really trying to help people understand and, you know, move forward in the idea of sound money, I think, and protecting their hard-earned savings.
Yeah. But again, I think I absolutely agree with most of what you said, but his focus does seem to be on the investment insurance side versus the money side, monetary side. And yeah, that's where we see things differently. Mm-hmm.
Like I was saying, that's an interesting and important distinction, I think.
Yeah.
Jim, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up today's conversation. We certainly touched on a lot there. Is there anything else you'd like to go over before we do?
If you don't mind, you introduced me as a partner in Silverback Precious Metals. And you were talking about Bob Coleman and you know, trying to highlight prices. But yeah, we're getting COMEX bars, sawing them up. This is inspired by Jake from Bison Bullion. Mm-hmm. And then for the shavings, we melt those down into rounds. But yeah, our premiums have stayed fixed. And that was the whole plan, is when we started it was, you know, we may not be the cheapest right now, but we're not going to raise our premiums as the premiums start to rise, because we, you know, we are literally tapped into getting the COMEX bars.
Well, at some point, wouldn't you have to cover your costs and stuff like that?
Oh, we do cover our cost. But you know, there's a difference between, you know, the issue is that all the mints, you know, they have fixed capacity. Mm-hmm. So as demand increases, if they can't keep up with capacity, the premiums are going to go up. But with this business model, as long as we can get the 1,000-ounce bars from COMEX or spot market or other sources, then we shouldn't need to raise our premiums, and we can scale our capacity. So we can, you know, sawing up these bars takes a certain amount of time. We can add saws, and you know, we can produce an awful lot of silver at a reasonable price if the demand is there, and we can do that without raising the premiums.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what have you seen for premiums rising since you've been doing it? Have premiums really started to blow out and increase here, let's say, in the last month?
In the last month, yes. I mean, when we got the idea, premiums were high, you know, near the beginning of the silver squeeze, premiums were high for a prolonged period. And then, of course, once we started the business, premiums come down, mm-hmm. right? So then our prices were not the lowest. They were close, but not the lowest. And then, yeah, the last several weeks, premiums, you know, we see the wholesale pricing as well. Premiums have gone way up. You know, there was 1 kilogram bars a couple of weeks ago were $1.30. Now they're $1.80. You know, that happened over the span of a week or two. And then some of our sources for 1,000-ounce bars have jacked up their prices as well. Thankfully, we're working with Ian of Arc Silver, and he's managed to been able to order another 1,000-ounce bar a couple of days ago at the same price that we've been paying. So yeah, it's definitely, and it's, premiums are going up. Stores are selling like crazy. And that's a good thing. Not the premiums going up, but the fact that the demand is there. Mm-hmm. People are waking up. You know, Wall Street silver keeps growing and growing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Jim. Well, of course, your guys' website, citizensforsoundmoney.org, has a lot of great resources and goes through a lot of the things that we talked about today. And of course, you guys are on Twitter and yourself at JimForsyth5. Anywhere else you'd like to point to?
At ForSoundMoney on Twitter, also for the official channel. And Citizens for Sound Money, it's with the number 4 in the middle. 4, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Jim. Thanks so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.